Hello, my name is Lauren Layfield, and this is Your Next Podcast, the podcast which creates a brilliant list of shows for you to try, adding a new one each and every week. This week is a very timely listen. My finger is right on the political pulse, I can tell you. The Modi Raj is a brand new series from The Economist, and it explores the rise of Narendra Modi and his transformation of India. Now, Modi was re-elected just last Tuesday, so this could not be more impeccably timed, or impeccably made, I might say. It's a real revelation.
The Economist.
I can say it's very shocking shabd barabar je pan it's very bahu punctual putana kapda mate chak.
Jitendra Chauhan is a tailor in Gujarat, a state in the west of India. I've come to one of his smart multi-story shops in the city of Ahmedabad to talk about his most famous client.
Modi kurta shu represent kare.
There's a whole section devoted to the Modi kurta. Jawaharlal Nehru, India's first prime minister, popularized the collarless Nehru jacket. The country's current leader now also has an item of clothing named after him. It's a take on a traditional tunic, but with short sleeves.
The vyakti Indian je e represent kare. Je kurta pehro to e lage is Indian like.
Chauhan tells me the prime minister is very particular about the tiniest of details. He notices if buttonholes are hand-sewn.
Can you describe Mr. Modi's style to me? How would you describe it?
Sauti pehla to straight, always straight body, style, straight body. Style ma particular khe tabne ke pi ama au karjo, stitching.
Narendra Modi started getting his clothes made at Chauhan's shop more than 30 years ago. Back then, Chauhan had just one small store, and Modi needed everyday cotton outfits. Things have changed since then. The most recent piece Modi ordered was for a big public appearance, the kind of spectacle the Prime Minister loves.
World Cup hadu jare tare yo nu hatu ke pai World Cup ma je Indian ni team no color che ne.
It was a bright blue waistcoat and matching scarf with an orange border. Chauhan says Modi was specific about the design. He picked the shade of orange himself.
Why orange?
Pogo karo to che main BJP no hetla made.
Across Ahmedabad, on the banks of the Sabarmati River, stands a newly built cricket ground. The Narendra Modi Stadium is the world's largest. And last November, 130,000 fans filled it for the biggest night in Indian sport, the Cricket World Cup final on home turf. Specifically, Modi's home turf. He grew up in Gujarat, and he was sent the stage that night, wearing the blue suit with the orange trim. It matched the Indian players' kit. As ever, Modi had found the perfect look to fit the moment. Narendra Modi's knack for switching guises to suit his audience is a huge asset when he pitches himself to a diverse country of 1.4 billion people. On the campaign trail this year, Modi styled himself as an economic moderniser. In an interview with the English language news channel ANI, Modi talked up his goal of making India a developed country by 2047, 100 years after independence from Britain. He talked about artificial intelligence and the digital revolution. He mentioned that Elon Musk is a big fan. In the 10 years Modi has been in power, India's economy has overtaken Britain's to become the fifth largest in the world. In that interview, Modi said his first two terms were just a trailer. But Modi also tried to reassure his critics.
When I say that I have a very big plan,
और उसके लिए बहुत बड़े बड़े फैसले हैं. किसी को डरने की जरूरत नहीं है.
When I say that I have big plans, no one should be scared. But some people are scared. Because there's a second, darker side to Modi too. As Prime Minister, Modi has cultivated his image as a strident Hindu nationalist. He has introduced Hindu first policies that threaten India's minorities, its 200 million Muslims in particular. And his authoritarian, illiberal brand of leadership is putting India's democracy at risk. Modi wore his Hindu fundamentalism on his sleeve on the campaign trail this year.
और पहले जब उनकी सरकार थी उन्होंने कहा था कि देश की संपत्ति पर पहला अधिकार मुसलमानों का है.
At a rally in Rajasthan, a predominantly Hindu state in the north of India, Modi slipped into explicit Muslim baiting.
जिनके ज्यादा बच्चे हैं उनको बांटेंगे.
The Prime Minister said that the opposition Congress Party promised to distribute India's wealth to those with more children.
क्या आपकी मेहनत की कमाई का पैसा घुसपैठियों को दिया जाएगा?
He asked the crowd, "Do you think your hard-earned money should be given to infiltrators?" It was a thinly veiled attack on Muslims. There have always been two Narendra Modis, the economic reformer and the Hindu nationalist. As Prime Minister, he has pursued both goals, doggedly. And this two-part vision for India has won Modi three elections, in 2014, 2019, and now, in 2024. Modi may well be the most popular politician on the planet, and he's positioning India as a powerful, independent player in a new world order. Now, he's looking at another 5 years atop the world's biggest democracy. So it's time to answer the question that's been on my mind since I first started reporting on India over a decade ago. When you look past the carefully crafted image, the pageantry and the showmanship, who is the real Narendra Modi? I'm Avantika Chulkoti. This is The Modi Raj. Episode 1, The Chaiwala Son.
Welcome to Vadnagar. Lots of traffic, lots of tuk-tuks, some handsome cows.
Getting to know Narendra Modi means going back to the very beginning, Vadnagar. It's a small town in central Gujarat where Narendra Damodar Das Modi was born in 1950, 3 years after independence. He was the third of six siblings, and his family lived in a single-story home with no electricity. As with anywhere in India, the thing you notice about Vadnagar is the noise. People shouting and cars honking at cows that block their way. There are women going about their business in the most fantastically coloured clothes. Groups of young men just loiter. People say Vadnagar has developed a lot since Modi's time. But even today, the town has a population of only 30,000 people. That makes it puny in Indian terms. I drove through the old town, a warren of narrow alleys, to reach the railway station.
So we're here at Vadnagar station. It looks very new. There's a nice blue train on the platform. But it's quite full, actually. There's people hanging out of everything except for the chair car, as far as I can see. This station is where Modi's story really starts. His father sold tea here, and Modi says he helped out as a child. The tea stall was being renovated when I visited. There was a life-size cutout of Modi nearby, part of an ad campaign for one of the Prime Minister's big welfare programs. Back when Modi lived here, the station had one platform. Since Modi became Prime Minister, it's become a tourist attraction. The national government has revamped the whole place. There are two platforms now, a pristine pink frontage and Modi's name on a big plaque outside. Modi's critics say this story about Modi in the tea stall is overdone. There's debate about what exactly his father did and whether the young Modi really helped out selling tea. Either way, being the son of a Chaiwala is a big part of Modi's identity now. He wears it as a badge of honour. In a Bollywood biopic about his life, the young Modi is shown leaping onto a train with a pot of chai. He rushes through the carriage, pouring cups of tea and collecting coins from his customers. The film paints young Modi as responsible, patriotic, wiser than his years. He's always helping his parents with something or the other. But it is cinema. I wanted to speak to locals in Vadnagar. People who knew Modi all those years ago, but it was hard to find anyone who was willing to talk to me about him. Some said they were afraid of speaking out of turn and getting in trouble. That gives you a sense of how much control there is over Modi's story. So I turned to the journalist, Nilanjan Mukhopadhyay. He's one of only a handful of biographers who had access to Modi, back when he was more open to speaking to the media. These days, Modi is less open to questions from journalists. Mukhopadhyay spent hours with him and got a window into the mind of the young Modi.
Modi directly told me that he would take his friends outside the village on expeditions and he would lead it.
Modi wanted to be the one giving out orders.
He would not want to learn anything from his classmates or his friends.
Mukhopadhyay spoke to one of Modi's teachers too. He told him about Modi's early ambition.
He acted quite a bit in school plays and school functions, but he always wanted the lead role. If you don't give him the lead role, he will not be part of it.
In the 1950s, Vadnagar didn't have much for the ambitious or the adventurous. But there was one activity in town that captured the imagination of the young Modi. On most mornings at dawn, men and boys dressed in khaki trousers, white shirts and black caps can be found in parks or Hindu temple grounds belting out this chant.
Namaste Sada Vatsale Matri Bhume.
They're in the RSS. The Rashtriya Swayam Sevak Sangh. You can think of it like a cross between the Boy Scouts and the Salvation Army, with a strong streak of Hindu nationalism. The group advocates for Hindu supremacy in India. It often demonizes Muslims. Some of the early leaders of the RSS openly took inspiration from European fascists. No one knows exactly how many people are in the organization. It's secretive about a lot of things, but estimates suggest there are at least 5 million members, all men and boys.
That is the RSS traditional prayer that is sung everywhere.
R. Balashankar is about the same age as Modi. He grew up in Kerala, a state in the south of India. He joined the RSS when he was 16. Modi joined when he was 8.
That is Namaste Sada Vatsale Matri Bhume Toya Hindu Bhume.
Can you translate the prayer? What are you saying?
This translation, it's difficult, but the basic point is that I bow before my motherland, and this is a great country, and I would even lay down my life, you know. I will do anything for its total uplift and its prosperity and to make it strong.
The prayer might be tricky to translate from Sanskrit to English, but the message is clear. It's about patriotism, pride, and sacrifice for the motherland. It's we, not me. Modi and Balashankar would end up crossing paths at the RSS headquarters in New Delhi when they were in their 20s. That's why I wanted to meet Balashankar. And because his experience as a youngster in the RSS would be pretty similar to Modi's.
I had not even heard about the name of the RSS, but we were told that it is a good organization, nationalist organization. My mother, she told me, why don't you go for a training program there? It was a 7-day training program.
Balashankar was a generous host when we met at his home in New Delhi.
I can make some coffee for you if you like.
No, thank you.
He welcomed me with plates of sweet, deep-fried Indian snacks and insisted I eat them, as we talked about what he learned at that 7-day training camp.
See, the living is very simple. We have to get up early in the morning at 4 o'clock.
In the early hours, they would pray and sing nationalist songs.
It is about the country, its history, about heroes, all those things.
Do you remember any of the songs you would sing in that?
I remember many songs, but I'm not very good at singing. And
I tried to persuade him, but he was adamant he wouldn't sing. The rest of the training camp involved pontificating about patriotism and Hinduism. And then there was yoga and drills.
Basically, a lot of exercise. And those days we used to have danda, you know, this long stick.
The sticks. This is what I really wanted to know about.
So what are you doing with the big sticks? Are you fighting each other? Is it like you're throwing things? Or what are you doing?
Fighting is at a later stage. To begin with, you know, we are trained to handle it. So it's a long stick. It is up to your shoulder. That is the length of the stick. And first it's how to handle it. And only at a later stage when you have trained a little with the stick, then we have a duel fight, you know, like we have in Kalani.
It's this physical training that makes the RSS feel like a paramilitary group. The organization is teaching young men to be fit, patriotic, macho, protectors of the nation even. One former head of the RSS described the organization's daily meetings as a center of hope for rapid action and undemanding help in case of emergencies and crises that affect the people, and also a powerful threat to the brutal and anti-national forces. In The Boy in the Branch, a documentary maker got an inside look at the organization. The film came out in 1993, but its message still stands. It shows young men being inducted into the RSS. Boys are shown dressed in khaki shorts, playing games, chasing and hitting one another, chanting and punching the air. At one point, a group jostles to grab hold of one boy.
Kashmir kiska? Kashmir kiska?
They're all chanting, "Who does Kashmir belong to?" To us. It's a reference to a contested territory with a majority Muslim population that has been the center of India-Pakistan conflict for generations. In an interview, an RSS leader explains that the organization believes India should be run in the interests of the Hindu majority. If the Muslims oppose us or didn't give us their support, we'll get back at them. Tit for tat.
I was quite charmed by the overall atmosphere, the people around, and the exercise. It was all very new to me, and I was quite excited about it.
Balashankar loved the training camp. He started going to the hour-long daily meeting held by his local RSS unit, the Shaka, which is the center of RSS life. And over time, the youngster transformed into a disciplined, devoted RSS man. Modi has said he was drawn to the RSS because of the nationalistic songs and the organization's reputation for discipline. And because the RSS offered him something beyond his life at home in Vadnagar.
Modi believes that his entire personality is the contribution of the RSS. His discipline, his style of working, his oratory, and his organization skill, his idea about the nation, all these things are shaped by the RSS.
The RSS was founded in 1925 when the British ruled India. The colonial leaders were holding national elections.
And it's the period in which, for the first time, Indians realize that in the future, power is going to be distributed as one person, one vote.
Vinay Sitapathi is an academic, and he's written books on India's political history. The founders of the RSS believed in a specific version of history, one where a lack of unity between various sects and castes weakened the Hindu community. This weakness, in their view, had opened India up to centuries of rule by invaders. Muslims, then Christians, the Mughal Empire, then the British. Their version of India was of a nation defined by its majority faith.
The aim of the RSS is to create a cadre of Hindus who are united, who are not divided by caste, by region, or by language.
In 1947, when the British signed the Act of Independence, they hastily drew a line between Muslim-majority Pakistan and Hindu-majority India, creating two nation-states. Partition, as it became known, led to one of the bloodiest periods in Indian history. Hindus, Sikhs, and Muslims attacked one another. Hundreds of thousands died. Millions of people were forced out of their homes. RSS leaders, with their vision of a united India, were seething. To them, India's new leaders, the Indian National Congress Party, had given up sacred territory.
It's important to realize that historically, the RSS has always shied away from direct involvement in politics.
Politics, though, would catch up with the RSS. In 1948, the organization faced its first major moment of reckoning.
At 5:03 Indian time, Mr. Gandhi came out of Birla House. He was wearing his usual white loincloth and a pair of sandals. He was still smiling. A thick-set man, in his 30s, I should say, and dressed in khaki, was in the forefront of the crowd. He moved a step towards Mr. Gandhi, took out a revolver, and fired several shots at almost point-blank range.
Mahatma Gandhi, the father of the nation, died on the spot. The assassin was Nathuram Godse, a Hindu fanatic and a former member of the RSS. In a written statement before he was hanged, Godse explained why he killed Gandhi. He labelled him pro-Muslim and accused him of being soft on Pakistan.
Now, he's not assassinated by the RSS. The RSS was cleared of any accusation of it. But he was assassinated by somebody who shared the worldview of the RSS and had the same criticisms of Mahatma Gandhi, namely pandering to Muslims, pandering to Pakistan, that the RSS had.
The RSS was banned for a year and a half. Thousands of the group's members were arrested. Its association with Godse made the RSS unpalatable to many Indians. The ban persuaded the RSS leadership that they needed to get involved in politics. They realized few politicians spoke out in their defense after the assassination. So they created a party. It was the forerunner of the BJP, Modi's party. The two sides and their structures were to remain separate. The RSS was to be about ideology, and the party was about politics. By all accounts, Modi was desperate to get out of Vadnagar. When he finished school, he upped and he left.
You know, there is a very standard kind of desire to leave home, not liking the controls of family. Those are the kind of things which I can, visualize, because I used to have similar kind of, moods.
Modi says he went to the Himalayas to explore his spirituality. He was inspired by Swami Vivekananda, a Hindu monk whose ideas about reviving the religion laid the foundations for the Hindu nationalist movement. Modi went to an ashram and tried to become a monk himself. It was there, apparently, that a spiritual leader told Modi that he was destined for a life of public service, not devotion. But the biographer, Nilanjan Mukhopadhyay, thinks there could be another reason why Modi left Vadnagar. He was running away from something.
He definitely did not like the idea of being married to this lady.
This is something Modi kept secret for years. He is married. It was arranged when he was a child. This is, unfortunately, a common practice in India. He was married at 18, but spent very little time with his wife, never had children with her, never had much of a relationship at all. These days, Modi presents himself as a single man, whose only commitment is to the country. He gets prickly whenever the marriage comes up. After his travels, age 22, Modi joined the RSS full-time. He was now a Pracharak, which translates as one who publicizes. It's a cross between a foot soldier, a missionary, and a campaigner. These full-time RSS workers are the pillars of the organization. They're unpaid, but their everyday needs, like food and shelter, are covered by the RSS. The life of a Pracharak is one of devotion, asceticism, and celibacy. Modi would not have been allowed to become a Pracharak if he revealed he was married. So he kept it quiet.
Sarva Shaktiman Sri Parmeshwar.
सर्वशक्तिमान श्री परमेश्वर
तथा अपने पूर्वजों का स्मरण कर
तथा अपने पूर्वजों का स्मरण कर.
It's likely he swore an oath to the RSS, like this one, captured in the documentary The Boy in the Branch. It's a promise to protect the purity of Hindu religion, culture, and progress. Modi dedicated his life to the organization. He focused on rising through the ranks.
Within the organization, he did not hesitate to be extra nice or extra courteous with the seniors, with an eye that if I am courteous, then I'll possibly be able to rise very quickly. So he actually took personal care of some of his seniors within the RSS, washing their clothes, cleaning their rooms.
But things would soon change. 3 years after Modi became a Pracharak, the RSS faced a second reckoning.
The president has proclaimed emergency. This is nothing to panic about. I am sure you are all conscious of the deep and widespread conspiracy which has been brewing ever since I began.
Indira Gandhi, the Prime Minister and the leader of the Congress Party, had been found guilty of electoral malpractice. Instead of stepping down, she doubled down. On June 25, 1975, she imposed a state of emergency. Civil and political rights were dissolved. Opposition leaders were locked up. The press was censored. She banned the RSS too. Thousands of its members were arrested. The emergency is still the most brazen attack on India's democracy post-independence. It fired up young people, including young RSS workers like Modi and Balashankar.
Organize resistance, organize people for demonstrations, preparing the literature, distributing it among people. That is a major part of the work.
The RSS went underground. It became a force for resistance, opposing the emergency. Both Balashankar and Modi were part of it. There's a lot of controversy around what exactly Modi was up to at that time, how involved he really was. But when he met Balashankar just after the emergency was lifted, Modi regaled his younger friend with stories of disguise and valour.
who could hide himself and how the police was never able to recognize him. He had grown his beard and changed his dress.
To disguise himself, Modi ditched his kurta, the traditional Indian tunic, for full-on 70s Western fashion.
Bell-bottom and all the kind of things, like jeans and all that. He was totally unrecognizable as a man, you know, his clothes and all that.
Balashankar got to know Modi well because they were teamed up for a big task, gathering testimonies from RSS members about their experience of the emergency.
He was very strict about his timings.
Modi would wake up at 4 a.m., pray, and then do yoga.
And from 8 o'clock till evening, continuously sit on the floor, he will work.
In an organization like the RSS, this precise routine didn't set Modi apart. What made him stand out to his peers, like Balashankar, was what he chose to wear.
He was always well-dressed.
Pracharaks are supposed to dress simply. They're not supposed to be image-conscious or outwardly ambitious. The RSS is all about organization over self, remember?
Even then, he was very particular about his clothing.
The tailor, Jitendra Chauhan, remembers meeting Modi back when he was a Pracharak.
Always straight body style.
He always had a straight body style. I have never seen him hunching. He always had an eye for the tiniest of details, like there should be no crease in his clothes. In style, he's very particular. He's unlike others.
Modi would take the fabric to Chauhan's shop and get his outfits made, just the way he liked them.
The half-sleeve kurta, that was his idea. He came up with that design and we made it for him. He used to come to me even for those ordinary clothes. Even then, when he was dressed quite plainly, he came to us because he had an eye for our good quality finishing and detailing.
Modi was eager to look the part. Perhaps he was trying to be seen. Balashankar certainly spotted flashes of Modi's ambition.
Narendra Modi had the vision. He used to tell me, see, when I will go back to Gujarat, most probably I will be working for politics. And he said that one day I am going to be a prominent leader in Gujarat.
In 1987, the RSS sent Modi on a secondment. It would mark the start of his career in politics. Remember the political party the RSS had formed after the assassination of Mahatma Gandhi? It had evolved to become the BJP. Modi's job was to work behind the scenes as a bridge between the RSS and the BJP. Modi proved himself as an organizer. His specialty? Big yatras. A yatra is something between a rally and a pilgrimage. Indian politicians love a yatra. They walk long distances or drive in open-top buses, grabbing any opportunity to give a speech or interact with the public along the way. Large crowds often follow. Modi began by organizing the Gujarat leg of a yatra, which had huge significance for the BJP. It was to end at the mosque in Ayodhya, a city in India's north. Remember the name Ayodhya, it will come up again, and it's key to this whole story. Ayodhya had been a flashpoint for Hindu-Muslim conflict for centuries. Many Hindus believe it's the birthplace of Lord Ram, one of the most revered gods in Hinduism. They say a Hindu temple once stood there. Muslim invaders built a mosque in its place in the 16th century. The yatra was part of the BJP's push to get a Hindu temple built at the site. It drove the agitation that led to a Hindu mob destroying the mosque a couple of years later. The yatra rallied massive support for the party, and soon Modi landed his first national assignment. In December 1991, he was put in charge of a yatra for Murli Manohar Joshi, the BJP president at the time. This yatra reveals a lot about Modi's character and his political strategy. It was to run the length of India, from the southernmost tip in Tamil Nadu to Jammu and Kashmir, right in the north. That's 2,284 miles of walking and driving. It would take 47 days.
The general buzz was that there is this man called Narendra Modi and he's doing an excellent job coordinating such a difficult yatra.
Nilanjan Mukhopadhyay, Modi's biographer, was covering the yatra as a journalist.
While you are travelling at a time when India did not have the kind of communications now,
the reporters needed phone connections to send their stories back to base. Connections were hard to come by on the road, and Modi spotted this.
There were typewriters, there were computers, and most importantly, fax machines.
He set up makeshift offices for the media wherever the yatra stopped. The yatra was to end on January 26th, Republic Day in India. The plan was to hoist the Indian tricolour in Srinagar, the main city of Jammu and Kashmir. After independence, the majority Muslim state had been given special semi-autonomous status. In the early 90s, an armed insurgency gripped Jammu and Kashmir. Militant groups were fighting to break away from India. The Congress Party was in charge of the country at the time, and the BJP accused them of losing control of the state. The BJP wanted to cancel Kashmir's semi-autonomous status. The plan was for the BJP president, Joshi, to raise the flag in front of the gathered press pack. It would be an act of political one-upmanship by the BJP and a show of dominance. Normally, the person running a yatra keeps a low profile. Not Modi. He used it as a platform to give rabble-rousing speeches challenging any would-be troublemakers.
Lal Chowk mein posters lagaye, diwaron pe likha hai. जिसने अपनी माँ का दूध पिया हो वो श्रीनगर के लाल चौक में आए.
Tensions were running high in Srinagar on January 26th. Gunshots rang through the air. The yatra had already come under fire from separatist groups along its route. The security services were nervous. They didn't want BJP politicians out on the streets any longer than needed. But Modi saw an opportunity. Joshi was poised with the tricolour in front of TV crews and press photographers. Shankar Singh Vaghela was a senior leader in the BJP. He was in the photograph too.
Big one. Modi and I, Joshi and I was small one. His main face, because camera, he was doing where the camera is.
Modi was looking at the camera because he knew where it was. So he is the main face in the shot. Joshi and I are tiny because we didn't know where the camera was.
The press snapped the three of them with the flag.
Nobody can recognize who am I. Even who is Joshi? He was the Modi.
Nobody can recognize who I am or who Joshi is. It's only Modi.
Vaghela looks back at this time with a mix of annoyance and amusement. That's why you can hear him and my colleague laughing. Vaghela says Modi upstaged him and Joshi. To be fair, Joshi is squarely in the photo, but Modi does look like he's in charge. He's this neatly bearded figure dressed in a smart woolen jacket, towering over Joshi, who's wrapped up against the cold in a cap and a saffron scarf. This was Modi the political operator. The yatra cemented Modi's position in the BJP, and in 1995, he was key in winning the party power in Gujarat. He climbed up and up from there.
He was seen as a stubborn man. He always wanted to do what he thought was right.
Some of Modi's contemporaries didn't like his ambition. Vaghela, who was an RSS veteran too, felt that Modi put himself ahead of the Hindu nationalist cause. That went against everything he'd learnt in the RSS.
A political ambitious...
He was politically ambitious, using RSS to enter politics. That was always his plan. He wanted to be in power.
And Modi knew how to get there. Part of his political success in those early years was in making sure he got on the radar of the top brass.
I'll say this about Mr. Modi, that he has his fundamentals very clear. He knows, or he decides where he has to reach and works to achieve that end.
Yashwant Sinha was part of the BJP-led government in the late 90s. He served as finance minister and foreign minister.
When I was finance minister, Mr. Modi came to me and requested me to visit Gujarat.
Sinha took up the invitation.
There was some function with regard to preservation of cows.
Cows are considered sacred in Hinduism, so it was pretty typical for BJP types to attend events like this one. What's interesting is what happened afterwards.
I had perhaps time at my hand before I caught the flight back, and he took me to the room in which he was living in Ahmedabad at that time. It was a small, very small room with a cot in the RSS headquarters.
It was sparsely furnished with a bed, desk and chair.
That was the style in which all RSS pracharaks, as they were called, they used to live.
Modi had been seconded to the BJP for several years by this point, but the RSS was still a big part of his identity. The two organizations shared the same core ideology, Hindu nationalism.
While BJP claims to be secular in its own way, the pro-Hindu slant was there.
This is important. India is, by its constitution, a secular country. But the word has different meanings in different places. In India, it doesn't mean the state is separated from religion. The state is just supposed to give all religions equal treatment. The BJP believed the Congress Party was pandering to minority communities and disadvantaging the Hindu majority. It had taken things too far.
The Congress Party had a record of indulging in minority appeasement. And BJP stood against this. BJP wanted everyone to be treated equally under the Constitution of India.
As did the RSS.
The relationship between RSS and BJP was umbilical.
The two groups were so close that as finance minister, Sinha would present his policy plans to RSS leaders before they were announced.
Because I was following liberal economic policies, often I was on the wrong side of RSS. And I felt that it was my duty to explain to them why I was doing what I was doing, which I did by going reaching out to them. So I continued with it for as long as I was in government, even in foreign policy.
How could they pressure the BJP? What was their power?
That power was because many of the people in the BJP were pracharaks.
Pracharaks like Modi, who'd proven themselves and were moving into politics. The foundations for Modi's political career had been laid. He got into office from there through a combination of hard work, shrewd diplomacy, and sheer luck. In the late 90s, political infighting dogged the BJP in Gujarat. The feud pitted Modi against Vaghela and began to break the party. Modi, having risen through the ranks, was accused of running the chief minister's office from the sidelines. The BJP leadership pulled him out of Gujarat and sent him to New Delhi. It was a dark period in Modi's life. He was away from home and alienated from sections of the party. But he put his skills as a negotiator and organizer to use.
And he became one of the early spokespersons of the BJP for television.
उस ग्रहण से हमारी मुक्ति हो जाएगी।
पर मोदी जी गुजरात में आपकी बारी का सबसे लोएस्ट वोटर टर्नआउट रहा है तो ये क्या डिसिडेंस के साथ एक सिनिकल एटीट्यूड नहीं है
जी नहीं इस लोएस्ट टर्नआउट का कारण सबसे बड़ा ये है कि चुनाव के मैदान में कांग्रेस में कोई दम ही नहीं था और जब
प्रतिस्पर्धी Nilanjan Mukhopadhyay, the journalist and biographer, would watch Modi on TV.
He appeared to be a person who was actually fit for television in the sense that, you know, the capacity to give the sound bite in 25-30 seconds, an exact composite thought, well thought out.
All the while, the BJP government in Gujarat continued to self-destruct. When an earthquake hit the state in 2001, it was the final straw. Clumsy management and corruption plagued relief efforts. Voters had had enough. And the national leadership of the BJP realized they needed a new chief minister to be the face of the party in Gujarat.
And so they need a man, if I may use another phrase, to make Gujarat great again. And enter Modi, right?
What's remarkable is that Modi had never held any elected office before. He might have been handed a poison chalice. He was taking on the leadership of Gujarat at a time when the BJP was in tatters in the state.
Hum Narendra Damodar Das Modi.
Ishwar na name saugand lau chu.
Ishwar na name saugand lau chu.
On October 7th, 2001, Modi was sworn in as Chief Minister of Gujarat. It was a huge job for a political newcomer. And only a few months into it, he would face calls to step down when rioting broke out across the state.
They used petrol like it was water. And they had these large hammers. Some even had swords and sticks. They swarmed in. They broke doors down. It felt like the mob were the rulers of Gulbarg.
Over the next 7 episodes, I'll explore how Modi survived and thrived in Gujarat, and how those early years in politics forged his vision for India. It's a vision that propelled Modi to the national stage and that has made India what it is today. A booming economy and an emerging global power, but also an increasingly fragile democracy, where many minority groups live in fear. I'll speak to people who've worked closely with Modi.
He has every quality to make the image of the country, you know, bigger and magnified many times on the world stage.
After about 2-3 years, he was a lot more independent, is a wrong word, but self-dependent in decision making.
Those who champion his vision.
We're seeing a government which is creating a strong brand for brand India on a global landscape. If you are a smart young person willing to give 20-30 years of your life to do something big, there is no place to be than India.
A lot of people had tears in their eyes. You know, it was like after 500 years of humiliation, we were witnessing a history where our Ram is back.
And those who rejected.
Muslims were just scared of what this man will do. What's next? What's coming our way?
In a sense, we have been convicted without trial. Convicted and punished without even charges being filed.
It's one of the basic tenets of democracy, that you're answerable. Mr. Modi is answerable to no one.
For exclusive access to all of this, you'll need to be an Economist subscriber. To unlock the full series of the Modi Raj, just search for Economist Podcasts Plus to discover our latest subscription offers. If you're already an Economist subscriber, thank you. Your support is what makes this podcast possible. Our producers are Alicia Burrell and Sam Colbert. Field production is by Mohit Rao. Research and translation is by Azania Patel. Our sound designer is Wei Dong Lin. The music is composed by Darren Ng. The series editor is Claire Reed, and our executive producer is John Shields. I'm Avantika Chulkoti. This is The Economist.
Such a good series, and I really love a dig into the past of a well-known figure. It's fascinating. To find the rest of the episodes of The Modi Raj, search for it wherever you listen to podcasts. Once you've tapped follow for that on Amazon, Apple, or Spotify, don't forget to tap follow for this show too, so you can find your next podcast. All my recommendations from the whole series will also be on Podcast Rex at www.podcastrex.com. That's www.podcastrex.com.